This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The investigation into the 2020 election will remain open as Michael Gableman continues to fight lawsuits challenging his probe.
I'm announcing my candidacy for the governor of the great state of Wisconsin.
Plus, GOP businessman Tim Michaels enters the crowded field of candidates running for governor. And we highlight the key takeaways from the new Marquette University Law School poll. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for April 29th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
J.R., we're going to kick off this week with some updates on the Gableman investigation. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says the investigation will go on and that he will extend his contract to allow Michael Gableman to give him basically the ability to still challenge his subpoenas that are really taking a long time in court right now. Now, we don't know the details of this new contract, but the contract was set to expire this Sunday. And all of this comes after, once again, we saw Voss being pressured by the former president, Donald Trump. And basically, in a statement, Donald Trump suggested that Voss could see a successful primary opponent if he doesn't keep this probe going. That quote from Trump is, "Anyone calling themselves a Republican in Wisconsin should support the continued investigation without interference. I understand some rhinos have primary challengers in Wisconsin, and I'm sure their primary opponents will get a huge bump in the polls if these rhinos interfere." Now, Voss then, of course, extended this right after the pressure from Trump, also from State Representative Branchin, who also sent out a statement that you would be, in a sense, suggesting he would be a fool if he wouldn't keep this going on. So Voss then, of course, extends this, and his statement also said, "The Office of Special Counsel will remain open to guarantee the legal power of our legislative subpoenas. Like I mentioned, we'll get through those lawsuits. We are also grateful," he says, "that Gableman will reduce his salary," but we don't know what Gableman will be making. Of course, we know the parameters right now. JR, he was making $11,000 a month. He's giving $676,000 taxpayer budget for this review. So here we are again, JR. Review is going to go on, and we don't know how much longer.
Yeah, and the question has been why. Why is Robin Voss keep capitulating to Donald Trump? And the theories that I've heard this week are that Robin has a primary challenger. Look, Robin's not going to lose that seat in November. It's a strongly Republican seat. He does all these small ball things we call in politics, going to the Lincoln Day dinners, the local events, answering constituent mail. He's very, very good at taking care of his district. This concern might be a primary. If there is, if there's enough of a groundswell of people about this Stop the Steal stuff who kind of turn out, and if you had Trump really focused on Robin and really kind of angry with him, maybe that would give him some heartburn. Likewise, we're watching to see if other primaries develop for Republican incumbents. We have a lot of retirements that have opened the door to who knows who's going to run for these offices. But might you see some primaries of incumbents? Keeping it alive through at least the primary, the theory goes, kind of helps keep pressure off that situation. Once primary's over, you can try to maybe push it aside, move toward the November election, and focus on looking ahead, not looking behind, but you run a risk there. The risk is Donald Trump pulls a Georgia, where he basically says, "You didn't do what I wanted you to do. Why should people go out and vote? I'm done with you guys." So there's a downside at each side, because the Marquette poll that came out this week had a very fascinating question about who's motivated to vote this fall. The Republicans who are most likely to doubt the results of the 2020 election are the most enthusiastic to vote. Those who are most likely to believe in the 2020 election or confidence in them are less enthusiastic to vote. What's that mean? Charles Franklin talked about it could suggest the people who vote in the primaries for Republicans are going to be more likely to be these 2020 Stop the Steal folks. The issue is, if you have a candidate on the ballot in November who is a Stop the Steal type Republican, you could turn off moderate Republicans and independents who don't want to talk about 2020 anymore. Most of us want to move forward. Mm-hmm. It's over, Biden won, nothing's going to happen about it. If you keep talking about it, you could turn people off. How do you keep both sides of that coin engaged for Republicans come November? that is a big challenge.
And that was very interesting in the poll. We're going to recap a lot more highlights in the MU poll later. But, yeah, it kind of just goes to show that when a lot of people had the theory of, well, you know, your vote was stolen, it didn't count, those allegations that have not been proven true of no widespread fraud, that, I mean, people, it is energizing people. You know, we thought, like you mentioned Georgia, that maybe it would prevent people from going home. Well, I don't trust the system. It's not working. It's not going to be fixed. Lawmakers haven't acted to clean up our election laws. But, it might change.
But are they motivated to vote for any Republican?
Right.
Or just the quote-unquote right Republican, or against a certain Republican.
Which type of candidate, correct. Staying on this Gableman topic, too, of course, the Gableman on a Steve Bannon podcast earlier in the month also said that Voss was threatening to basically pick up all of his office supplies. He has an office in Brookfield, and some people went out there this week, some reporters, kind of checked it out. The office kind of looks largely empty, but we don't really know who's in the office. No one has really seen Gableman, so it just kind of remains to be seeing what's going to happen. I think we both got the same confirmation that Gableman has offered to buy some of those office supplies, at least Voss's spokeswoman.
But for how much? With whose money?
With whose money? And that's what we're getting to our next point, JR. You had some records request kind of detailing a little bit more about how much he has spent. Now, in that letter, basically, this is a letter that Gableman wrote to Voss that you got, JR, that said, closing the office would render a pointless and waste of taxpayer money on the entire investigation. Gableman offered to reduce his salary, which we mentioned earlier was $11,000 a month, to $1 a year. Gableman also wrote that the possible downside of keeping the office open would be the legal fees to defend his subpoenas that he issued with Voss's approval. Now, the legal bills that you found, JR, through open record laws show the legal tab has already eclipsed to $25,000. So we really don't know where is the other money, but it kind of just gives us a clear picture of where we're at right now and if he's going to have any money in the future to keep this going.
Well, this is the rest of the story about the pressure campaign on Robin Voss. So you had Trump's statement, you had Janelle Branch's statement, now you have this Gableman letter kind of saying, look, if you shut it down, you undercut our position in all these lawsuits because there's only been one lawsuit filed by Democrats. That is Democratic Attorney General Josh Call, who has filed an action in Dane County Court seeking to prevent Gableman from interviewing Megan Wolf, the state's top election official, in private. She says she'll be happy to do it in public in front of the legislative committee, but not in private in his office. They don't think that he has that power to compel that. There's that. It's the one lawsuit Dems have filed about the investigation. Gableman has gone to court in Waukesha County trying to compel the mayors of Green Bay and Madison to give private depositions. If they don't, he wants them jailed, essentially. Now, there's also a lawsuit that's not about the investigation itself, but the records from it. American Oversight, liberal group, it has filed a lawsuit seeking these records. So looking at what's going on, I got the letter that Gableman had wrote saying, you're going to undercut our position in court if we stop this thing. I'll make all these offers. It will weaken the office of the speaker, actually, if we shut this thing down. It also gives Gableman a platform going forward if he keeps it open. So with the lawsuit that Call has filed, about $250,000 legal bills there. I have not seen any yet for the action Gableman filed. He's also his private attorneys in that case helping him out. American Oversight, it's about $90,000 in taxpayer money for legal bills about that lawsuit. So yes, the budget is $676,000, but we're already north of $340 and change. We're talking, this is more than $1 million to taxpayers now to do this investigation. Robin hinted in a statement that the whatever Gableman does going forward will stay within the original budget for him. But that doesn't count the legal bills. Those are still piling up, and they're going to be going on for months because in one case, it was pushed back to July 11th, I think.
I was just going to say, we're not going to see some action on this until July in one of the lawsuits. You've mentioned, you know, a few others. So
yeah.
it could take some time. And the more and more hearings that are scheduled after this without a judge's ruling, of course, everyone knows, the more money it's going to cost.
And remember, the contract that Gableman and Voss signed that expires on Saturday, it had a provision that basically envisioned once they finish these lawsuits, they'd sit down and have a conversation of, well, do we need to do more? Do we need to have a revised report? Do we need to do more investigation? So that amended contract always kind of envisioned it going on more, but there's been this chatter in the background that Robin wants to shut it down, and that may have prompted the Gableman letter, the Branch's statement, and Trump coming out, because There are people in Wisconsin who want this to go on who have Trump's ear. And, well, we know Gabelman's been down there to Mar-a-Lago, right? We know Branchon has had communications with him, been, you know, praised by Trump. So there are people who want this to go on who have Trump's ear. There's going to be pressure going forward on Voss about this, however he handles it.
And I think there's still a question of what else can Gabelman produce in his final report. We know he had the interim report where he suggested lawmakers to take a, quote, hard look at decertification. Robin Voss is not on that board, but a lot of Gabelman supporters are still, you know, rallying for that. But we know there's no legal pathway here in Wisconsin. So whatever this final report produces, I think is also keeping people on its toes. What, if anything, will come out of it? Also this week, we touched on it last week, JR, that Tim Michaels, a businessman, is entering the crowded GOP field for governor. He is officially launched in Brownsville, which is where the Michaels Construction Company is. He basically talked to supporters, kind of casting himself as an outsider. We know already two in the race, Tim Rantham and Kevin Nicholson, have also kind of, you know, grouped themselves as this anti-establishment from Madison on their campaigns. But Michaels also touched on, he didn't touch on elections, which was a little bit surprising, but he talked about how he's going to turn Madison upside down and basically said that he's going to be tough on crime. So let's hear first a little bit from his campaign rally, and then we'll dive into the details about a little bit more about him.
Enough of the political bickering. Enough of the left and the right not getting along. We got to bring people together, sit down, work this stuff out, and with proper leadership, we will get this state on the right path to great success. Now, there's a bunch of bills that were put in front of Tony Evers, and he vetoed them all. I'm asking the legislature to reintroduce those bills, and I will sign those on day one that empower parents, that take the power away from the teachers' union, and we can get education back on track here in Wisconsin. Crime is at a point where it should have never have gotten here. There's a 30-year high in assault, murder. There's 10,000 carjackings last year in Milwaukee. I will back the blue, and bad guys are not going to like me. I need your help. Let's get this done. Let's get to work. Thank you.
So I think the big headline here is that Tim Michaels does have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. He can basically self-fund his entire campaign, even though he's getting in pretty late. But that's not really going to have an impact on him. He did go on WISN's Jay Weber show basically saying that he's not going to accept donations from lobbyists or political action committees. And the minimum contribution he'd accept from individuals is $5,000. But there's also... before, I guess, Thursday, there was a lot of questions, ethical questions, about whether or not his ties to his construction company, if elected, whether he would distance himself from that. And on Thursday, shortly after the JS reported on that, he said that he would divest his construction company if he wins office to avoid any potential ethical conflicts.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's no good time for us to tape this show, it seems like, because every Friday after we're done, something else breaks.
That's very true.
So Michaels filed about 3 hours after we finished taping last week. Mm-hmm. One of my sources told me that he put $980,000 into TV for the first week. Now, let's do some basic math. It's 15 weeks to the primary. I'm not saying he's going to keep up that pace, but if he does, that's getting close to $15 million in TV. That's a lot of money. The challenge for Michaels is he has to not – to first – build back his name ID. He hasn't been on the ballot in 18 years. People, you and I know who he is. We've talked about him off and on various elections for several cycles. There's an opening. He has to get reintroduced to voters. Then at some point he's got to tear Becky down or take her down somewhat. Or somebody has to, because she has got a built-in kind of level of support in the primary. There are now three high-profile candidates trying to get that undecided / anti-establishment piece of the pie. It's not enough of a pie for the three of them. They have to take something away from her to win the nomination. How's that going to work? And how nasty is it going to be? The nastier it gets, the better it is for Tony Evers. A couple things to watch with Michaels. So one, he's been part of the road building industry for a long time. His family business is quite expansive. It's one of the biggest infrastructure companies in North America. Where was he at in Right to Work? Right? That was in the big Republican battles in 2015, I think it was. Now, he's trying to say where I am is different than where my company is, right? The can is different from the company. But the road building industry didn't like Right to Work, right? Because it impacted their employees who were going to get paid less, essentially. Or prevailing wage, for example. Right. Those kinds of issues. There were some worries about their labor force. He's going to have to answer those questions. There's other baggage for him that he's going to have to address. Where has he been on these big Republican fights? Whereas Clayfish was part of the Walker administration. He wasn't necessarily the one doing the fighting, right? Walker was leading on those things. But she can say, I was part of the effort. So that's a challenge for Michaels going forward. And how they addressed 2020?
I was just going to say he didn't address the 2020 election in his speech, and we know that every candidate has been almost on the record about that, kind of different extremes, I guess you can say, but those are questions that he'll have to face, as well as I think we brought up last week, his previous stance, I think from 18 years ago, like you mentioned, on gay marriage. I think it was an event, actually, you covered about that many years ago, so it's a lot of things that once media is able to ask him these questions, not just, we see a lot of these candidates go on conservative radio, right? But a lot of them haven't been available for different questions on these
Clayfish is now talking more about 2020 and that she compared it to Deflategate, that, you know, the whole thing with the NFL with Tom Brady and the air pressure in football is that the thing was rigged. I mean, they're trying to figure out how to navigate that dynamic we talked about a few minutes ago of there are the two segments of the base, right? And if you neglect one or the other, you might lose them. So how do you address that?
And who maybe will get the endorsement at the
Donald Trump.
State GOP convention. Now there's another person, so that's four. You need 60% delegates' votes to get the state party endorsement. But now with another candidate, I mean, there is a possibility that maybe no one will get to 60%, but we just don't know. Rebecca Clayfish is leading the polls. That kind of, she's been considered the front runner. That's kind of leading into our next topic, JR, with the MU poll. Let's start with the governor's race. Clayfish clearly on top with 32%, Nicholson 10%, Rantham 4%. Not a huge change from previous polling, but of course, important to note, Tim Michaels was not asked about this because he just announced this week, and we know Marquette does these polls a few weeks before.
Yep.
I think the more interesting revelation from the MU poll was the U.S. Senate race on the Democratic side. Of course, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes and Lazary are getting much closer. Lazary's really closing the gap there on Mandela compared to the previous poll. You could see it up there. Galuski with 7% and Nelson with 5%. So important to note, though, I think we've said it a few times on this show, JR, is that Barnes has not gone on TV yet. And Lazary has been, I think, ever since last year, has been pushing out his messaging to voters.
So a couple things. I love the Marquette poll. Charles Franklin does a great job, very transparent about what he does. That said, it is not my favorite poll in the world for gauging a primary. And the reason is Charles starts with a sample that is basically voters, all right, and asks them, you know, if you're a Democrat, kind of like these questions about the primary, to get his primary sample. The campaigns do a much tougher screen to figure out who is really going to vote in those primaries. So they're a little bit better in terms of that for gauging it. Also, the margin of error. It's plus or minus 6.6 points on the Democratic Senate side for that one, 5.6 for the GOP primary. The GOP primary poll, without Michaels in there, some limited value. However, one thing you note is Nicholson's not moving in that poll. In the Democratic poll, there's movement, which you'd assume so, because both Lazary and Galuski are on TV. Barnes is not. Now, I don't know if it's 3 points, which is basically within the margin of error. It's, you know, kind of they're neck and
very
neck,
true.
Essentially.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a much wider gap or even flipped. I've heard private polling has Mark Mandela still in the lead. My questions are, when's Mandela going to go up on TV, and what can he do on TV? Remember, at the end of March, he had $1.6 million in the bank, which is, I don't want to say dismiss $1.6 million, but it's not a lot of money for an ad campaign. Remember, Tim Michaels is doing $1 million based on TV's first week of the race. So if Lazary and Galuski, if this momentum is real, and remember Lazary put out a poll of his own a month or so ago saying that he had changed the numbers, right? If that momentum is real, can Mandela blunt it? And how does he blunt it? Does he get up for 3 weeks, four? What can he do on TV? Because he's been kind of like working off of name ID, right, so far. Well, now Lazary and Galuski are getting better known in that primary. That is a challenge for Mandela Barnes because, yes, 1.6 million again. Decent amount of money to you and I as journalists.
Yeah, yes.
Lazary gave his campaign $3.45 million in the last quarter alone. So even though Mandela is raising more from individuals than Lazary, Lazary can keep writing checks, we think, to spend more on TV than Barnes can afford with what he's raising. That's a challenge for Mandela Barnes.
And it's important to note with that U.S. Senate race that nearly 50% still don't know who they want to vote for. I don't think that's completely crazy out mm-hmm. there, but because a lot of people don't know and people are not paying attention yet, besides us political people that are really involved in it. But
I would bet that the if you did a more strict screen for Dem primary voters, you might get a different number. That said, there's still value in what Charles is doing with the shift. Watch the momentum, what changes. Next poll will be out in June, I think. Be fascinating to see what's going on there, because if Barnes is not up on TV by then, what's going on? That's a huge question.
That is a big question. Last thing we're going to hit on the MU poll, we kind of touched on this in the beginning, was the views on Gableman's probe. You know, not a lot of people have not heard about it. I think in past polling, this question has been asked in many different ways that people just are not familiar with it. Maybe if you're in Madison, maybe you're reading the headlines that a lot of us are writing about, but some people just don't even know who this man is. Let's also just hear from Charles Franklin. We're going to just toss to a video real quick on kind of how he was just talking about other statistics throughout the poll about how the direction of the state is going.
And they're still grouchy. If anything, they're a little grouchier. This time, 36% right direction, 56% wrong track. We've seen three successive polls that were already pretty negative on this question, and they've simply become more negative. It's striking that people can be this pessimistic about the state and its direction, and yet still have a net approval rating, a net positive approval rating of Tony Evers. This is a dramatic drop, I should say, from where we were on this question before the coronavirus hit in early 2020, when we were up close to 60% saying we were headed in the right direction. And right direction has fallen pretty solidly through the rest of 2020 and through 2021, and now it's continuing into 2022. So this isn't a short-term change. This is something we've been seeing for a while. Maybe it's connected to COVID, maybe it's connected to other things, but it's not a new development.
And JR, let's just briefly mention Governor Evers' approval numbers. I believe it was 49 favorability, 43 disapprove of his job performance so far. What's your kind of take on this?
Small change from February within the margin of error. What's remarkable to people I talked to is that Evers' numbers have a durability in spite of all these problems Democrats have. So Joe Biden is upside down by 10 points for job approval rating, 43-53. That's not a great place to be. We've talked a lot about November, and Evers' three big problems are going to be Joe Biden, running government, i.e. the unemployment problems, and public safety with Kenosha and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So Biden's one of your headwinds, and you're still at 49%. That's a pretty good place to be. Now, almost everybody's concerned about inflation. Like 90-some percent are very or somewhat concerned about it. That's a problem. The right track, wrong track number, it's negative 20 points, and yet Evers is in positive territory. How is that possible? Are people just going, it's not Evers' fault, it's that guy's fault, these are going poorly. You know, maybe it's some of that. The challenge for Evers is, can you keep rising above these dynamics, these elements in the environment that are not good for your party? Maybe. Also gets back to the Republican primary. The uglier it gets, the better it is for Evers. Whether it's the Senate primary or Democratic Senate primary or the GOP governor's primary, when I talk to people, they're not worried about money. If Rebecca Clayfish, Tim Michaels, Kevin, whoever wins that nomination, if they have $0 in their campaign account August 10th, doesn't matter, because the outside groups will spend so much money. Same for Mandela Barnes, Alex Lazary, Sarah Galuski, Tom Nelson. But if there is a divisive primary where the nominee is battered and bruised and the base is split, then you got a problem. Right? For Evers, it seems like he's got this nice guy persona that maybe is helping him kind of deflect some of the negative national stuff about Democrats and can help him rise above. But can you keep doing that as it gets more and more locked in about inflation? Oh, by the way, GDP was down 1.4%, I believe, in the first quarter. Like, there are all kinds of things that are making people unhappy and worried.
Right. And some people are now worried that we might be hitting the next recession. Yep. Dems in Congress are going with that storyline now with gas prices going up. I hate that R word, but who knows, right? Let's move on, JR, though. Sorry to cut you off. Let's get the stock picks. We got about 5 minutes left. Rising this week, Derek Van Orden.
Yeah, so a couple of things. One, last quarter, he had $1.8 million in the bank. The four Democrats combined had less than $700,000. We saw this week the National Journal, which is one of many publications nationally that handicap House races. They have the 3rd District as the number one seat in the country, most likely to flip. So that's noteworthy. It's obvious why. It's a 50-50 district that's been trending toward Republicans. Van Orden already ran once, lost narrowly to Ron Kind. He's in good shape to win it in a good environment because all these dynamics, right? You've got inflation and Biden's in the White House, and it's just a challenge. Now, we also have the Congressional Leadership Fund, which is a GOP-aligned super PAC, laid down about $700,000 or so on TV between the La Crosse-Eau Claire market and Wausau. Wausau actually captures that finger of the third that goes into Stevens Point. Mm-hmm. So there's TV there. It's not as much as actually the House Dems put down a little while ago. But the CLF is portraying this as, we're so confident in this seat flipping, we don't need to spend more money. It's basically in the bag for us. Now, Van Orden has some issues with being at the January 6th by the protest at the Capitol. Right. He says he wasn't there, but there's pictures of him like on the Capitol grounds, et cetera, et cetera. He hasn't put to the test on that yet. So we'll see how that plays out. But I don't know that voters in the fall are going to vote based on what happened in January 21. They're concerned about pocketbook issues like inflation, like gas prices, like what's going on. Yeah. So those things usually kind of dominate that stuff.
And mixed this week is Senate Republicans because of, once again, right after we taped this show on Friday, we kind of had a change of direction from Senator Dale Cuenca.
So he was the big winner under the maps last week, right? Well, so on a week and a half ago, he told me he's going to run for reelection. On Tuesday, he told me he changed his mind. I asked him why. He said he was 80% there when he talked to me the first time. He could never get to 100% there. The reason is he's got four kids. The oldest is 14, eighth grader. By the time Dale would be done with that next term, that oldest one would be out of the house, graduate high school and gone. He didn't want to, in his words, half-ass anything. He can't half-ass anything. He can't be at home with his kids, on joint finance, focused on his job as a lawmaker. Also,
he's in a part-time job.
He's in the Army, Reserves. He was on up call of duty at 200 days each of the last 2 years. I mean, like, he's got a lot going on, and he doesn't want to miss family stuff. So here are the challenges for Republicans, all right? The path to 2/3 majority is still there. I mean, the map is obvious. You hold on to Dale's seat. You hold on to the seat of Roger Roth in Appleton area. He's running for lieutenant governor. Both of those seats have a slight GOP lean. If you look at the average performance of the 16 and 20 presidential race and 18 governor's race, head-to-head Democrats, Republicans. Good Republican environment should be okay. But the fifth has been trending Democratic. Biden won the redrawn district by 500-700 votes in 2020, so it's not like it's a deep red district. Dale, between having $200,000 plus in the bank at the end of December, being an incumbent, having enough of an independent streak that he'd win over like moderate voters, would have put it not off the table, but been a much tougher beat than whoever Republicans find. Now, the nomination paper deadline is June 1st. They've got 32 days to find someone. Get a campaign rolling, get the nomination, which all can be done. It's not that hard.
Right. We've seen it done before.
But who? That's the challenge. And I'm getting all these Republican names being floated because it's like they got to find somebody. Now, again, back to that 2/3 majority, you hold Dale's seat, you keep Roger's seat, both of them are open, and then you look at you're trying to beat Democrats in the open 25th district up in northern Wisconsin, Janet Buley's, or beating Jeff Smith. But this makes a calculation more difficult for Republicans having the seat open and having to worry about that one this fall.
And following this week, Kevin Nicholson didn't move much in the polling, but also Tim Michaels is trying to steal his messaging in a sense.
Tim Michaels and Kevin Nicholson both are business guys. They both have military backgrounds. They both run as outsiders. Tim Michaels can write a check. Kevin Nicholson can't. Kevin Nicholson has to rely on Dick Uihlein to write the check. That is a big difference. Now, again, we don't know how much Michaels is going to spend between now and the primary. Dick Uihlein Finance Group spent $11 million on Kevin Nicholson back in 2018, the Senate primary. I don't know if they'll spend again. But you add up, you have more competition for Nicholson for that lane he wanted to run in. He's not moving in the polls. There's a Marquette. And you've got a guy with a bigger megaphone with a similar profile. That is going to be a challenge for you. Now, the caveat is Nicholson's burn it down message is more in line with the MAGA base right now, Republicans, right? Michael sounds more like, I'm going to turn Madison upside down, but I'm going to work inside the system. Kevin wants to tear apart the system.
Right.
So, but I don't know if he's going to have enough of a megaphone to get that message out, because Michaels could drown him out, especially when they have the very, very similar profiles.
All right. And we do want to end the show just kind of honoring Elaine Fainey Schreiber. She was the former First Lady of Wisconsin. She died on Monday at the age of 82 in Milwaukee after many years of battling with dementia. She served as First Lady from July of 1977 to the 79, while her husband, Martin, was Wisconsin's governor in the late 70s. And we just want people to know, if they want to learn more about Schreiber, Wisconsin and I did put a little documentary together about the family's battle with her Alzheimer's. And you can find that in the Rewind's description. You can also subscribe too. All right, that will do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Take care and have a good one.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.